This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. And I hope we will have a show next week.
Well, we're coming to you live from the... not so live, actually.
No, not very live.
Pre-recorded from the bunker at cliffcentral.com.
Right. No. And in Canada's next week, they got a huge bunker underneath. And then, who knows where?
Yeah, well, you have to shield yourself from the radiation, the incoming fallout from the North Korean strike.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking that woke Twitter has found us out. I'm just saying, North Korea is going to destroy us. The tensions are rising. They almost destroyed Japan the other day. Yeah. Kim Jong-un, yeah, he's got to be in his bonnet about something.
Yeah, they just set off a 100-kiloton hydrogen bomb. Just about 30 kilometers, I understand, away from the Chinese border. Apparently, they could feel the vibrations in China, at least in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for Donald Trump. You know, the one.
Feel sorry for Donald.
Yeah,
Trump.
The 1 hour he's helping people pack food into like pickup trucks in hurricane, well, in Texas rather, and then the next he's tweeting about escalating tensions in North Korea and putting up sanctions against anyone who trades with them.
Well, he said he's thinking about that.
That's a terrible idea. How can you sanction trade with China? America is not going to exist.
It's a good point. But we've potentially found the solution, because even if North Korea is going to nuke us all, we just need to get to Mars relatively quickly.
Indeed. And on the way there, we need to eat, of course. And once we are on there as well, we need to eat as well. So just, you know, fortuitously, to help our listeners get to Mars as well, we found a food scientist who used to work for NASA to speak on the podcast.
Yeah, so Michelle Pachonik, former NASA food scientist, involved in all of that kind of stuff at NASA, and she's been in South Africa for the South African Association for Food Science and Technology, or SAFOST. She gave some talks over there, and she's been kind enough to join us on the show today. Welcome to the show, Michelle. Thanks so much for coming on. Michelle Pachonik, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great, thanks. Correct me if I'm wrong, I saw on your sort of Skype handle that you're from Houston. Is that correct?
Until about 7 weeks ago, I lived in Houston. I still own a house in Houston.
Shame.
Which
so
flooded.
It did flood.
Flooded in Harvey,
Family and friends are all okay?
All the family and friends are, my son who and his fiance are fine, friends are fine. Many of our friends were affected by the flood. Our neighborhood is one of the key neighborhoods that floods quite frequently. We're near one of the bayous, and so
so this has been catastrophic.
It's catastrophic. Looking at the pictures from Houston and recognizing where the pictures are being taken, we've lived in Houston for 32 years. It's been heart-wrenching and devastating, and you know, fourth largest city in the country, and it's not clear how they're going to
recover,
build back up.
Yeah. Well, if anyone can, I'm sure the U.S. can do it and get it done.
And Houston, it's amazing hearing the stories. People who have been flooded are still out there volunteering their time, donating, doing whatever they can to help out their neighbors and friends and even people who they don't know. And it's really been wonderful to see how helpful and giving the people of Houston are, as well as the rest of the country. But people who've lost everything are still helping out.
It's wonderful. All right, let's get on to the business at hand, which is that you're a food scientist. So before we even talk about your career and all the stuff that you've done, what's a food scientist?
So a food scientist is a scientist in whatever area you want it to be in. I happen to be more in the chemistry area, but it could have been engineering or sensory or microbiology. But it applies that science to food. And so the special part of food science is that it is a multidisciplinary field. And so you get to network and work with people from all disciplines, but all with the key focus of science of the food.
So if we go to a shopping mall and the grocery store, and we take something off the shelf, we don't even think about it. How much work and how much science goes into a lot of the stuff we eat?
An incredible amount of science goes into what you're eating. So anything from the package. Is that the right packaging material to provide the right barrier properties for a shelf life of what you need that food to last for?
Mm.
The chemistry, are the ingredients the right ingredients to provide that shelf life? Are the ingredients the right ingredients for the flavor? So we've tested the flavor. What about the nutrition? So we've tested for the nutrition, what the content in that nutrition is. And, it goes on. How is that food processed? What back to the nutrition, what's on the nutrition label to tell the consumer what that content is.
Mm.
So it's just a lot of science and thought and consideration has gone into each food product that you would find in the grocery store.
And what's amazing to me is that despite all this work and research going into food, I can still go down to the supermarket and buy some vegetables for a very, very low price.
You can. And part of that, you meaning like a canned vegetable, not fresh,
right? A canned vegetable or tinned goods of sorts.
So a couple of things. One is a lot of that have been around for a long time. We already know how to process that. We know how to, if it's just a plain, plain vegetable, that's already been done. So there's not as much research involved. That research was done 30 or 40 years ago. But now let's think about a new product, whether it's a different flavor of vegetables or a different rice mix, all the time and effort that has to go into that, or a new ready-to-eat meal preparation that's either shelf stable or in your freezer case. That may all be new products, and that's where the effort comes in.
Right. But even so, okay, for example, McDonald's, it's not maybe the best food in the world by any means, but it's a processed food, it has nutritional qualities in it, and it's some of the cheapest food in the world while being not the most nutritious, but being fairly, nutritious for what it is, if you compare it to the price at least. I mean, that's quite an amazing achievement.
It is, and the other thing to consider is that the profit margins in food products tend to be much lower than the profit margins, let's say, for high-tech product or jewelry or something like that. So that's also the reason why the prices are low, and for the competition reason, that if someone else is going to price it lower, then they're out of, they don't sell their product. So it's a very competitive industry.
Okay, and you've been obviously involved previously at NASA. You were involved with food technology there and food science. What did you do?
I did a few things at NASA. So I started out and continued for about 14 of my 17 years as managing the food science research for future Mars missions. And so there's where, I had to use my science background and look at the integration and understand how the food and the food system interacts with not just the human, but the other systems within the vehicle that would go on to Mars. I also had about 3 years opportunity to manage the food system for the shuttle missions, the last few years before the shuttle was retired. So there I was, as my family says, I was feeding the astronauts, so making sure that our shuttle astronauts had the food they wanted for their 7 to 14-day mission. And then the last 3 years I was part of the management team for the Human Research Program. So the Human Research Program, which does fund the food science research, but looks at all the human research needed to go on to Mars. So, yes, food is very, very important, but also what about the physiological changes going on in the body, bone loss, muscle loss, cardio changes? What about behavior issues? You're going far, far away from home for up to 3 years. And so we were looking at all of the human risks and mitigating those risks through research.
So in your research, I mean, first of all, the distinction to be made is, how different is it producing food for astronauts in that environment compared to human beings on Earth? Is there a massive distinction between the two?
There's a lot of distinguished changes between the two. So first of all, unlike here on Earth, our crew members are only eating the food that we provide them. They can't go off to McDonald's or to their favorite restaurant because they don't feel like eating at home. So we're providing them with all their food, and we have to make sure that that food is nutritious and safe and acceptable. And the other big difference is we have to be very careful about how much that food weighs and how much trash it produces and what volume it takes, because this is all launch mass and volume, and that's all very expensive to launch. The numbers I've heard is it's about $1 million US to launch a pound of anything to Mars, because Mars is a longer mission. It's less than that to go to International Space Station. So you have to be very careful to make sure that that everything you're putting into that food and how you're packaging it and how you're stowing it is the most efficient way without sacrificing quality, safety, acceptability, nutrition.
So on those shuttle missions, let's talk about the past stuff before we talk about the future stuff. It's obviously freeze-dried food. Is that fair and accurate way of describing
it? 30% of the food is freeze-dried.
Okay.
So we have a lot of different foods, and we currently still man the International Space Station and have since the year 2000. Mm. But all the food, we've got what we call our pouched food or wet food, and that's most of that is, I'll say it's a canned food in a pouch. Mm-hmm. We call it thermostabilized. And we also have about 8 meat items that are irradiated to what we call commercial sterility. So, again, not very similar to a canned food in how much we've killed the microorganisms, but through irradiation instead of heat and pressure. And then, of course, we have our freeze-dried foods. And then there are beverages that are all in powdered form, whether it's coffee in whatever way you take your coffee or tea, with cream, with sugar, with lemon, or black or plain. It's all premixed, different flavored drink mixes, orange and lemon and lime. And then we have what we call them the natural foods, but they're the middle aisle of the supermarket store, the shelf-stable items, whether they're fruits, dried fruits, nuts, granola bars, things like that, which you can just – that we don't have – they'll repackage it at NASA to individual serving sizes, but there's no extra processing that happens.
And any good stuff, like, you know, is it kind of slim pickings when you go into space?
Is it just airline food, really?
No, actually the food is rather good. So there's about 130 choices of food items, plus then the beverages on top of that. And we get very positive feedback from the crew saying the food is really good. The problem is not the food. It is more the monotony. So even with 130 different items, if you're up on International Space Station for 6 months, or we've had a couple of crew members up there for a year, or we go to Mars for 3 years, imagine just having a choice of a few items. And this 130 items covers both breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so, you start getting tired of the food, and when you're in transit in microgravity or weightlessness, it's much more difficult to sort of mix and match the foods. Once they're on a surface of a planet and there's a little bit of gravity, it may be easier to say, you know, today I'm going to put in my tortilla chicken, and tomorrow I'm going to do beef. And you can do that on orbit, but it'll be a lot easier
when messy.
Things don't float around and get messy, yeah.
And, well, my next question really is that, what are the nutritional requirements for people, well, both in at the space station or in shuttles, and arguably, what do you think the requirements will be for people who end up on Mars for a substantial amount of time?
So we do know some things, and others we're still trying to learn. So we do know that the caloric needs are about the same. And part of that is it does take some effort when you're on orbit and weightlessness to keep stable and still if you're trying to do some work. And so there are, you know, places where you can put your feet or hands so that they're keeping stable, but it's still a lot of work. Plus, to prevent our bone loss and muscle mass loss in our crew, the requirement is to actually exercise about 2 hours a day. And so because of that, the caloric needs are about the same. Nutritional needs are typically about the same. We have increased the calcium level a little bit.
Yeah.
They've increased vitamin D because you typically get vitamin D from the sunshine. Well, they don't get any sunshine, so they actually do take vitamin D supplements. And then items like iron should actually be a little bit lower, because when you go up in orbit in weightlessness, you actually have a fluid shift in your body. And because here on Earth, a lot of our fluid, our water in our body, is from the waist down. Well, now there is no up or down or gravity. And so some of that, so you actually expel some of that fluid within the first couple of days of launching. And because of that, the iron content in your blood gets can get higher. And so it's part of the recommendation. Correct. So part of the recommendation is to bring that iron level down, or not to at least increase higher than the recommended daily allowance. And then what we're trying to look at, or they're trying to look at, I shouldn't say we because I don't work there anymore, are, you know, like, should they be looking at some of the functional foods more, probiotics, antioxidants, to protect the body from some of the environmental concerns, especially going on to Mars. I think the biggest concern is going to be, again, if they're not eating well because they're getting tired of the food, they're not going to get the right nutrition. But then there's also, we don't know yet, or they don't know yet, whether things like bone loss or other physiological changes actually even sort of, you know, you lose some and then you're going to even out, if you think about a graph. But we don't know that. There's been two crew members, a Russian and an American, who have been up there for 1 year, and the data is still being analyzed, so we don't know if there's any changes from like 6 months to a year, and then they'll have to figure out what happens between 1 year and 3 years. The expectation is, we think in most cases there will be some sort of stabilization at some level, but they don't know what that will be.
Yeah, it's always been interesting because Mars has about is it one third the gravity?
3/8. It's about 3/8 gravity. The moon has 1/6 gravity.
Yeah.
And so our best guess, and they can do some centrifuge studies to figure it out where they spin people around in like a little container. But our best guess is moon is much more similar to weightlessness at 1/6 gravity, and Mars might be closer to having some impact on the gravity. So bone loss, we don't expect there to be as much bone loss on Mars, but it's still not full gravity. You're still not getting as much sort of weight bearing onto your muscles and bones as in on Earth.
But is there any increase in height? Because I mean, in theory, if we go to Mars, I don't know what they've mapped, but are we sure that human physiology would be able to cope? Let's say a baby born on Mars. Do we know what that human would look like at age 30, for example, if they survived?
Yeah, there is no, at least nothing I know of, let's put it that way, understanding of what would happen. What we do, there has been some studies at NASA on like plants, especially on International Space Station. Can you grow plants where roots normally go down? Well, there is no down. Well, it ends up that the plants go to the light and the roots go to the water. So if you put the water
in the sky,
or you put the water down, the roots are going to grow that way.
Okay.
I don't know what would happen to a young person, you know, and there's been discussion. How old should those astronauts be, or the, those crew members be? Because it may be, it'll be, it will likely be an international mission to Mars. Should they be young, where they're more healthy, more able to handle any physiological changes? Or should they be older because they may be more mature? Or maybe if they lose bone loss, it's not as
significant
because they're already losing some bone mass anyway. They're older. So that's the kind of questions that a lot of our scientists are going to be asking and providing pros and cons to management to give them those to allow them to make those decisions.
Michelle, another question from me really is, during the research of actually finding food for consumption in space, has there been any of that technology research used for food on Earth, so to speak? I would assume the shelf life of food that you worked on is relatively high, maybe a few years even. Has there been any research to implement for food on Earth?
It's a good question, and actually there was a little bit of discussion at the meeting that I've been in about use-by dates and whether we should be extending them or not. You know, the main purpose of the food industry is to feed the public. They do have a purpose to make money also, and so they have less interest in having extended shelf life foods. So they're okay with, you know, a shelf life of food that's a year old. The shelf life at NASA is going to be, for a Mars mission, has to be at least 5 years and probably closer to 7 years. And so that's unheard of in all sectors except one, and that's our Department of Defense, where they do want to keep some inventory of food that is shelf stable in case of war or disaster or something like that. And so NASA's worked very closely with the Department of Defense in developing these foods together. And some of these pouched items started as the meals ready to eat through our military or Department of Defense. And NASA has reformulated them for NASA needs and nutrition and all that, because our soldiers, their nutritional needs are much higher because they are 20-something-year-olds who might be marching or hiking for long periods of time and need many more calories than our astronauts do. So, but we have worked with them. In the food industry itself, we're starting to see in the last few years some changes, and I don't know if we can attribute it to NASA and our Department of Defense, but you're seeing more pouch products, and you certainly have seen that in Europe, and I don't know about South Africa, where the pouch products are much more prevalent than canned products. And NASA uses pouch products because it's much easier to stow, because they're flatter and they don't have round, they're not round,
yeah,
which
edges.
Provides gaps, and they're less heavy, the pouch products, and that's why our military uses it, because they've got to be carrying all this food. And what we're finding is, as distribution costs get higher in the industry, the public sector, it also becomes much more enticing to have these foods in pouches versus cans. So we are seeing some changes like that.
Well, I'm actually just thinking, just came to me now, but if we all start having our food delivered to us by drones, then it makes much more sense to have pouch food instead of canned food, just from a weight perspective as well.
Yes, yes, you're right.
Yeah, so I'm sure a lot of our listeners would have seen a movie like The Martian.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite movies.
Okay, good. So I assume they did some things right, because if you're a scientist and they didn't, then you'd probably be a bit upset with it. So for those who haven't seen it, Matt Damon, the single unluckiest man on Earth, who always gets left behind.
Or on Mars.
saving Private Ryan, and he always gets left behind somewhere. He basically gets stuck on Mars. His crew leaves him behind, assuming he's dead, and he manages to get by creating his own garden of potatoes in a area that's not a vacuum of space. Is that a realistic proposal? Is that kind of an idea of what would happen if we were to go to Mars?
So there is some talk about, or I think it will happen, where we'll grow some plants on the Mars. They'll be in growth chambers that are, you know, have the right level of oxygen and carbon dioxide and the right lighting and the right temperature. The Martian actually, you know, that was a very large growth, I'll call it a growth chamber, but area that he grew his potatoes. And it could be, you know, depending on how much NASA or the crew depend on the crops will be dependent. Well, that will decide how big that will be. If we were to feed the crew with just plants, it would have to be probably twice, maybe, I don't know, or about the same size as what Matt Damon had. But maybe all is needed is some fresh fruits and vegetables, and including potatoes. And the potatoes are a nice, and I don't remember the correct term, but potatoes can sort of regenerate on itself. And you don't need the seeds, you just need the eyes. And so you can continually have a source of potatoes, and whether that's white potatoes or sweet potatoes or yams, the same thing happens. But it could be bell peppers or strawberries or cherry tomatoes. They would all be dwarf-sized plants because you want to have more fruit and less greenery and stuff that would have to be dried to get the moisture out, and then maybe the dried leaves and roots would become fertilizer, but everything should be recycled when you're on Mars. But yes, what Matt Damon did is good. I don't know. He, in the book, it claims he has enough protein from those potatoes. I'm not sure I'm convinced about that. Mm. But to give a little bit of history on the book, Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, actually started writing this as a blog. And the blog, he would get, and he just basically did research on the internet and came up pretty close. But because he had a blog, he was getting people commenting on the blog saying, no, you did that wrong, you did that wrong, this is how it should happen. So the book is pretty close. And then when he published, he took all those inputs and made it better.
So it's crowdsourced.
Pretty close. It really was. And, what I enjoyed about the book, as well as and the movie showed it a little bit, is the critical thinking and the science thinking that the main character went through on problem solving and going through it. And yes, there were a few incorrect items that they had to do to make the movie work. Or even the book work. One was the initial dust storm. You wouldn't have a dust storm like that on Mars. The exercise room in the movie, you would never see an exercise room that large. and then, you know, my first thought when he went off and he was, I think, trying to get rescued, and he was in the space suit in space and he wasn't tethered. And it's like, no, you're always tethered. You can't. So there were certain things that were off. But in general, Andy Weir got it right.
So, I mean, we've been talking about food, and just the assumption was made that we'll get to Mars. The question is, for what purpose? What is the philosophical purpose of going to Mars? So, Elon Musk has something which says he's afraid of a giant catastrophe on Earth, and all human knowledge is lost completely, along with humanity. We had a previous guest who actually wants Earth to destroy itself through global warming so we can create other type of political systems off planet, so to speak. But for NASA itself, what is the value of sending people to Mars?
There's a lot to learn from about the solar system and about space, and robots can't do it all. And so humans will go and do that critical thinking and analysis in real time, because there is a communication difference of about 20 minutes each way. So if NASA gives a command to the rover, it's not until 40 minutes later that we know whether the rover did it or not. So and humans tend to explore, and learn. And so another reason to go to Mars. And Mars is probably, besides our own moon, is probably the most accessible planet for us to go to.
And to your knowledge, was any talk of sort of terraformer in creating, making Mars green, essentially? Is that a big plan, or is that more sort of theoretical? You know, you get these sci-fi drawings with these massive greenhouses and under domes.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. So there's a couple of things. One is there is an agreement. I don't know what they call it, the Planetary Protection Act. And similar to at least our national parks in the United States, where they say the only thing you should be leaving are your footprints. We have a similar edict, I guess you'd say, that says we're not going to contaminate the Mars surface or any other surface with something. Now, having said that, yes, we left flags on the moon, et cetera, but I was just talking to someone a few weeks ago, and their claim, and that was their opinion, is that Mars is not going to be our salvation if the Earth gets ruined from climate change or
whatever else,
you know, or whatever else happens. Mars will not be the solution, but there is in people's vision, the hope is that we would have, similar to the International Space Station, we would have a continued presence on the Mars surface. And what I doubt that would be 100 people. I think it would be closer to 6 or 10 people, or maybe 3 people, but we would start small and grow from there.
Yeah. And is there, previously the idea was we go to the moon and then we launch from the moon to Mars, because launching off something with basically no gravity or very little is much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Is the moon, the idea of setting up a colony on the moon out the window at this stage? It just seems reasonable. 2.5 days away. It's you can kind of wave at it. the
yeah.
communication is quick. If there's a problem, you can get there quickly.
Right. We'll wait and see. So the moon was a plan for a while, as you discussed. Then it went away. We're going to do an asteroid recovery mission to test some of our technologies. The latest, I think, has us going to sort of orbiting the moon, because then you don't have to launch from the moon's gravity.
Yeah.
And they call it a Lagrange point. So it's equal gravity pull from the moon and the Earth. And then you would launch from there. That's the last I saw of the proposals.
Mm.
But all of that is being proposed, and the last I heard, the U.S. Congress has not approved that plan. Yes, it would make more sense to do some of this testing of the technologies closer to home, and actually they're talking about even docking something on the International Space Station that is separate from the space station, where we could test some of those technologies also.
Just quickly on the International Space Station, just because you've had some exposure, has that been quite a good success?
Yes, it has been a success. We've learned a lot, both about the human physiology, behavior, and so yes, and it has been continually manned or humanized. I don't want to say manned since 2000. We've had our first 1-year mission, and there's discussions about having some more 1-year missions, so that NASA and the rest of the space agencies can better understand the physiological changes in the humans and behavior changes and all that. So and even understanding, did they get more sick of the food after 1 year versus 6 months? And so those debriefs, I haven't seen any of the results, but certainly the two crew members have been debriefed and asked those kinds of questions.
So this might be in the realm of science fiction, but why bother with food at all if there is a mechanism to make all the benefits of food easier to literally swallow, as in a pill or a drip or something to that effect? Or are we still like quite far off from that?
I think we're pretty far from that, but more importantly, food, if you think about, and this has been sort of the vision that I always go back to, is imagine you're on the space vehicle and you start seeing Earth get smaller and smaller and smaller, and realize it's going to be another 3 years before you're going to see Earth getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You are really isolated from Earth, from family, from friends. So food tends to be one of those things that you can still have control over. So you can decide, I don't want chicken today, I'm going to have beef. Whereas it's probably not your decision that you do this experiment or this task, because that's on your timeline and you have to do it. But the food gives you some choice and some psychological feeling that you are in control for something. And so if that choice is, I'm going to take a pill or put an IV in me, that's just not going to be as pleasurable as eating your dinner, having some soup or your breakfast. And so food will never go away. The other thing we've learned is when you talk about shelf life of food, extending it to 5 to 7 years is going to be a huge challenge. But what we do know is that your supplement pills, like your multivitamin pills, lose their nutrition faster than the food.
Now, that's actually a very interesting point. A lot of people do tend to forget about the social benefits of food.
Mm-hmm.
So it could also be a way for astronauts, and I'm not sure what you call people on Mars, people who are on Mars, to actually get together at certain times of the day to eat a meal and discuss things. That's also another benefit of food, which, sometimes even here on Earth, we don't actually see that benefit.
Right. And in fact, it is up to the commander for each mission on the International Space Station, but most of them will require their crew to eat dinner together for that very reason. It's really a good time to discuss, decompress, and just relax and have a good conversation.
Hmm. I don't know how much in your expertise it is, but moving a little bit away from space to the advancement of food on Earth. So we discussed packaging and some of the slightly different ways in which we're starting to distribute food. What do you make of meat, for example, that's now being manufactured in labs?
I think in the future that meat might be very useful. At this point, it is so much still in the basic science realm. It is costing a lot more money and time to produce those meat cultures than it does to grow a cow and slaughter it for the meat. That does not take into account all of the environmental footprints and all that. But one time they made, I think, a hamburger patty, and people said it was good, but it wasn't the same as
eating a real
hamburger patty that you just took off the grill, and it just wasn't that same texture and flavor and all that. So I think it's got potential, but I also think it's a few years, if not many years, down the road before we're gonna see it economically feasible, in my opinion.
Sure. So you think there's any next big thing, or we're going to carry on plodding along?
I really like the future for 3D printing. I think that's where you could have some sort of basic, and I'll call them pastes or something, where you have, I don't know how it will work, but maybe
the
a
right
protein paste
basically.
And a carbohydrate paste, and you mix and match with some flavors and colors, and you come up with something that is edible, acceptable, and nutritious. And so I think that's going to be the future that we might see.
So you print a cheeseburger?
Yes.
It's a great notion, actually.
I approve of it. But Michelle, as a scientist, I mean, okay, so just for analogy, I feel a bit sorry for very good chefs. Those people that prepare food very, very well, because...
And Ramon is French. We need to just throw that in there.
And an awful chef. I'm terrible at cooking. I burn water. If it's possible, I would do it. But chefs have, so a good friend of mine is a chef, and it's very difficult to actually entertain him at home or at a restaurant, because the food he makes is superior to the food that is served to him in other establishments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a food scientist, does this happen to you where you actually look at food at the supermarket and you think to yourself,
that's terrible.
Yeah, the way it's done is terrible. The packaging's awful. It's not as good as it could be. It's completely off topic, of course, but as someone who has a PhD in this, like, does that affect your buying choices?
It does, and it actually so one of my – and my kids are now grown, but one of my rules or my personal rules was, it was very important to me to make sure my children had a healthy dinner every night and that we ate together. And I don't like to cook. I think I've gotten to like it more now, but it was always a chore, but it was important to me to do that. But you know, I sort of laugh because my husband's gotten me out of the habit, but when I first met him in graduate school, and he's not a food scientist, and I would go to a restaurant and I'd start evaluating the food and say, oh, that texture's wrong, they overcooked it, or that's not the right flavor, or they added some strange flavor, what is it? And he said, you've got to stop that. We're going to dinner to enjoy the food. Don't critically analyze it. And you put 10 food scientists together, and that's what we do.
Must be just quite something.
I remember many, many years ago, we were, it was before one of the Institute of Food Technologists annual meetings, and we were there a day or two early for another pre-meeting, and eight of us went to dinner, and we started analyzing the menu and the food, and the waitress is looking at us really strange, and we just said, get used to it. There are 18,000 of us showing up soon, and you're going to see this a lot.
Shame. Well, my mother-in-law has a background in food science, so tomato sauce or ketchup, she is rabidly against, basically, and ice cream as well. She not a fan of ice cream. Knows how they make it, and based on just how it's made, she's not the biggest fan of it. So I know the neuroses that come with a career. I suppose that's one of the pitfalls of being a food scientist.
It's the pitfalls, but it's also the fun part.
Sure.
It's an activity that, you know, so you can take and the one thing when I was at NASA, I would say people think they're an expert in food science because everyone eats. And they all know food, and there's a lot that goes on beyond that. And so, again, you're exposed to food everywhere, whether it's in your home, at your workplace, or at a restaurant. And so you get to apply your career, your knowledge, your science, wherever you are. And that's, you know, you don't see that in every career. So to me, it's an advantage because it's just fun.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have someone passionate about what they do.
Yeah, about something that we don't think about on a daily basis, but which we use every day.
Yeah, absolutely. As we said, you know, I think most people just take something off the shelf, don't even realize how much work's gone into it. But you and your 18,000 friends have done a hell of a lot of work. Michelle, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Are you still in South Africa for a while?
I go home on, when do I go home? I think it's Thursday night.
All right. Well, thank you for coming. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. You've been in the Cape, so it's a beautiful part of the country.
Yes, it's a wonderful city. Yes.
And I hope you've enjoyed some good food and wine.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very, very much for coming on the show. We really do appreciate it, taking out of your time and your day.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Excellent. Excellent. And, that's it from us.
The pleasure is all ours, Michelle. Thank you once again.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Cheers, eh? Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Right. So that is Michelle Pachonik, former NASA food scientist.
I'm going to go I'm white. I only shop at Woolies, right? So I'm going to go there and read all the packaging and say, this is inferior.
don't all Woolies customers do that? Just read the packaging and then make decisions. On
depends who they're buying for, right? If they buy it for themselves, sure. If they buy it for the domestic worker, nah, it's okay.
Ramon, a completely non-controversial podcast made controversial in the last 30 seconds. Thank you for listening. A little bit of something different on the show, but we thought we'd take the opportunity with having someone of that caliber in the country.
Yeah, indeed. And Jonathan told me 2 hours ago that we're recording today with this person. So, a bit unprepared, but I don't think we seemed unprepared. But nevertheless, John, thank you. Good work on your part.
If you enjoyed the show, as you know, you can always subscribe on iTunes or your preferred platform. You may also find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, Renegade Report Group, and the Renegade Report page. If you really like the show or you would just like to support us, we are on Patreon. You can find us there and donate towards the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.